This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Lake County Council has given final approval to an ordinance that, if it's approved at least by the county commissioners, the council would have authority to be able to make purchasing decisions and some other approval over data processing and the like. It's a question that has come up in recent weeks with the county council and the Lake County commissioners, and it's turned into a bit of a political controversy, I suppose, especially ahead of the elections. And some people here in Northwest Indiana are not exactly sure it may be a good idea. And one of those who has some questions about this particular move by the county council is Michael Griffin. He is the town clerk treasurer in Highland, but he's also an adjunct professor at IU Northwest. He teaches public budget and finance, and Michael's with us to talk about this issue and some of the state law and some thoughts behind it. Thanks for being with us on the program today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, for folks that are not necessarily familiar with this plan that the Lake County Council has, what is what they seem to be wanting to do, and where do the questions come up as to whether it's a proper thing to do at all?
Well, thanks for asking about that. In Lake County and in St. Joseph County, unlike all the other 92 counties, well, I should say all the 91 of the 92 counties in Indiana, the Board of Commissioners is not both the legislative and the executive body. So if you go to Porter County, the legislative body is the commissioners and the executive is the commissioners there. They have what is called pure commission form government. And the county council there serves only as the fiscal body.
Right.
Under legislation that got adopted in 1981, St. Joseph County and Lake County and any other county that would elect to adopt that law, none have, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Marion County and Indianapolis has a special law where the mayor is, in fact, the executive of the county as well as the city. Those two counties, that's Lake and Porter, have the Board of Commissioners only has powers of an executive. It has no lawmaking ability. So in Lake County and in St. Joseph County, the county councils serve the function of being both the legislative body and the fiscal body. So the way that an ordinance, which is the local lawmaking power, is passed in those two counties is an ordinance or a resolution is passed by the county council, and then it still needs to be adopted by action of the commissioners. So if a majority of the commissioners agree with that ordinance or resolution, it becomes adopted. And if a majority does not, or they choose to veto it in the same way that a mayor or a governor or a president would veto their laws promulgated by their legislative bodies, then the county council, in this case, would have a chance by a two-thirds margin, a five-vote margin or more, to override that. And this was a body of reforms that took place around 1980 first, because in 1980 we moved from a series of separate titles, Title 17, 18, and 19. Those are the big binder books that actually contained the positive or general law of the state, which had operated under a body of thinking that is commonly called by government scholars Dillon's Rule.
Mm-hmm.
Dillon's Rule is named after an Iowa judge named John Dillon, which basically had a regime in which the theory of law was that states are actually recognized by both the national and their state constitutions, and any power that was exercised by a local or a county government was a power that had to be directly given to it by the legislature. So if a city, town, or a county wanted to pave roads, it had to have an express grant of authority, sometimes implied, from the state legislature that created the county, city, or town. That had gotten to be cumbersome, and there was a large movement throughout the country where many states had already granted their counties, cities, and towns, or their local government form, counties are considered part of that in most constructs, to pass rules without having to go to the legislature. So in 1980, there was a comprehensive rewrite that had been commissioned by the state to bring home rule and its governing ideals to Indiana. So the idea was we would get rid of direct permission to do things granted directly to the locals by the legislature and allow them to make their own laws after a general or a broad power spectrum was given. So 36-13, firstly, Title 36 then got adopted. It was a comprehensive rewrite of the local government laws. And they were bound over into that law. So what happened then was 36-13 got adopted, which formally gave home rule to counties and cities and towns in Indiana. 36-1-4 got passed, which formally gave a description of the general powers that local governments could have. Then 36-2 was passed, Article 2, mm-hmm. which gave an express description of powers to counties. 36-3, express powers to Indianapolis. 36-4 for express powers of cities and towns wanting to get incorporated. 36-5 actually was the article that governed towns. 36-6 is the article that governs townships. And that was it. And then they decided they needed to give broad general powers and broad areas of legislation. So 36-7 conferred a body of planning and development powers. 36-8 gave a broad description of public safety powers. 36-9 gave a broad public works and transportation power. And 36-10 gave a broad power with regard to culture and recreation. And that really was largely what was left in that title until about 10 years ago. They took libraries out of the education title and put it into local government. And they also added something that the late Senator Sue Lansky wanted, which were regional sewer districts.
Right.
So that brings us to the recent development where, in the course of reading, Counselor Jorgensen, I believe that he's a pretty accomplished attorney, mm-hmm. came across 36-1-3.5-5, which was part of a larger chapter that was implementing that concept I told you before about this radical departure from Dillon's rule, which basically is an idea that says, unless the state says you can do it, you cannot. It went from that idea to home rule, which basically says, unless the state, if it doesn't say you can't, you can.
Uh-huh.
So that's a broad writ. Now, since that was passed, by the way, home rule's been been modified a great deal, and there's a lot more can'ts in it now than there used to be. But in 1980, we probably were at the zenith of the pinnacle of that idea being embraced by the state, and it was adopted and everybody operated under it. About a year later, in 1981, that legislature also felt that they needed to make some refinements to it. So they passed 36-13.5, sticking this idea in between 36-13, the home rule law, and 36-14, which began the process of defining general powers that local governments had. And they believed that there had been express grants that the state legislature had actually conferred on certain counties, either the executive body or the legislative body, and they decided that they needed to correct for that, too, and transfer those powers. So this chapter is really sort of the second step in the full implementation of this concept of moving from Dillon's rule to home rule.
Yeah.
And the specific statute that Councilor Jorgensen discovered was the one of the several that said powers that had formerly been exercised or directly been under the jurisdiction of the state of Indiana as a direct grant to this locality or this county, we're now going to restore to the following places, which was, in the case of Lake County and its legislative body, jurisdiction over salary payments, frequency, mileage allowances, and the county purchasing agency, the county data processing agency, all of which had been previously governed by a statute that was located in the old Title 17, all of which had been repealed. So that's the thing that they're operating from. Now, what complicates what I think that they've undertaken is the law that got passed also after that initial change of laws, also in 1981, which was the organizational laws just for St. Joseph County and Lake County that I described earlier,
yeah.
In which, unlike the other counties in Indianapolis, which has a special law that we shorthanded call Unigov, they basically decided that they would also give just executive powers to the county commissioner, and they would give just legislative powers to the county council and not blend them as they do in most other counties. And in doing that, that would be the law I'm going to start to talk about, which is also a 3.5 law. 36-2, remember, that's the general structure of governments under this new regime of law. 3.5, it starts to spell out expressly, not in broad detail, the powers that the executive branch has and the powers that the legislative body has. Specifically, the executive was granted the supervision over administrative offices, except those that are operated by elected officials, and it gave it the power to contract, specifically contract, and I want to talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
It did give the legislative body the power to establish by ordinance new county departments or divisions and agencies whenever necessary to promote efficient government. That, too, would have given the county council power possibly to do what it's doing now, but I believe that they're relying on a law that was really about transferring jurisdiction in the context of moving away from Dillon's law and going to home rule.
Yeah.
Dillon's rule and going to home rule. And it's not quite clear that giving them the jurisdiction, that is the legislative body of the county council, meant as much jurisdiction as they may think that they're going to be able to exercise. What I mean is, I think that there's an inherent conflict in those two laws passed roughly at the same time, implementing different concepts, that may be the problem. And it goes down to the idea of the power to contract is expressly granted to the county commissioners, and contract is actually by its virtue the act of purchasing. A purchase is a contract. Even if it's just a contract where I'm going to go to the dime store, such as they still exist, and I'm going to buy some candy. The offer, it's got the four elements of a contract. There's an offer and acceptance if I buy it, even if it's on point of sale. There's mutuality because I understand going to the store, there's a bunch of offers of things that I can buy, provided I'm willing to pay the price. They'll give me the good or service that I want, and I give them the money. That's consideration for the bargain. So you've got the four elements of contract there. And contracting power has been expressly given to the commissioners. Now, I'm not saying that the county council can't do what they've done. It's certain that they can create departments, and they could reconstitute a department of purchasing and data processing.
Right.
I'm not even really quarreling about whatever the rationale was for the county council to want to do that. I just think that there's an inherent tension in that law that would need to be worked out either by a conversation with the two bodies and an agreement by compromise, or if they have to litigate it. Since the power to contract was still expressly given to the commissioners, as well as the power to supervise agencies under it, it's just not clear that the legislative body could create an agency solely under it that is part of running the government. And it may be because of that transfer. It's just not clear.
Now, Michael, do you think that because it's generally accepted the fact that the county council, Lake County Council in this case, has what's called the power of the purse because they have to review the budgets and the like, and they have to approve the budgets because they in turn have to go to Indianapolis to be officially approved, do you think that maybe the council thought that, well, we have the power of the purse, we can just kind of extend that power, so to speak, to everything, and maybe they just realized that maybe we just could try and work things out with the county commissioners and see if we can be able to take over these things that before still had to be taken a look at by the county commissioners. Like, for example, if the county sheriff comes up with something, he's got money in the budget, he still has to get approval in a way, especially if he has to ask for more money to be able to get approval to be able to do what he wants to do.
Clear that the power of the purse is one of the most robust powers, and I sometimes believe that no local government or county that I'm aware of anyway has ever sort of appreciated just how robust that is. So one of the things I want to talk about is the history of appropriations, which in America really come to us by a historic fight between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton. Chris Nolte, I told you I was going to go kind of nerdy on you on this because I actually like this sort of policy stuff, but and I've actually had to teach home rule because in my portfolio, although I haven't done it recently, because I've mostly just done graduate studies, but earlier in my work as an adjunct instructor, I would regularly teach an undergraduate class in urban policy and structure, and we would talk specifically about what I've just described to you about the move from Dillon's rule to home rule. The power of appropriation could be much more powerful than they say. The county council, it seems to me, with those powers without even creating new departments or reorganizing them, could tell the commissioners, if they had five or more people to agree because they'd have to survive an override, they could basically say any purchase that is tied to an appropriation in, I don't want to really use the sheriff because that's really tied to what the reports are. Some of the news reports are tied to a belief that there's an internal dispute that's informing this decision to do this. And I don't want to seem like I'm picking a side on that. I would really like to confine myself to the merits of the policies that are being argued in the broader sense. So let's say that they didn't like how the commissioners are spending money in its office. It's not inconceivable that at the time of appropriation, they could tie conditions to its use. So they could say this can't be spent on anything such as X, Y, and Z. Or they could try to see how far the contracting provisions of the statute that grants specific powers to the county commission and specific powers to the legislative body in Lake County under the state law, could they say, yes, we agree that the commissioners have the power to contract, but we will still have to ratify.
Yeah.
So it would be kind of like the permission to spend is still a big deal, and it's an inherent check and balance that governments, a strong executive, strong legislative body have from the Congress and the president to not so much in Indiana because it's sort of a weak governor system, but it would be very much like cities in Indiana where the mayor can actually contract. No one else can take that power from the mayor, but the legislative body can, in many cases, tie, I don't think many have, conditions to when things can be spent and when they cannot be. They could, for example, indicate that we're not taking away the power to contract, but there'll have to be a review of any contract for an amount over a certain dollar amount. The other power they have is to take away permission to spend, which is what an appropriation is. And as I give you this sort of minimalist illustration, the way that we govern money in government, this is true in every local government in all 50 states plus the District of Columbia, most counties throughout the United States, the federal government to a lesser extent, and many states. We use this concept of a fund. When we think of funds, we think that that's money. But a way to think of what a fund is pretend every fund is just a checking account. So think of all of them as different checking accounts, but they have a special rule. They have to have two things in place before you can spend the money. They have to have actual money in them. They have to actually have money, cash, and they also have to have permission to spend that cash. So what an appropriation is permission to spend. So if I have $10 of cash in one of my funds, say the general fund, but I have no permission to spend it or no appropriation, I can't spend the $10. If I have $10 of permission to spend, meaning I can have a $10 appropriation, but I still haven't received the $10 because there's no $10 in it, it hasn't been deposited, I can't spend the money.
Mm-hmm.
I have to have both cash and permission to spend, and they have to be roughly equal to the actual money on hand or money expected to be on hand. So what they could do is reduce that. If I wanted to get the attention of a department head or a particular department, I might decide to reduce your appropriation to $1. And then you'd have a lot of trouble working because just showing up to work probably costs more than $1
yeah.
to turn the lights on the building and to take a draw of your salary. So the point is that's a very robust power. Whether they were using that concept and extending it to mean, well, we can take away a power from the commissioners, that's a little more complicated of a road. So I do think that absent some sort of entente between the county council and the commission, we certainly know that there's an express power unrelated to that transfer of power statute that I believe that the county council is relying on that they seem to have discovered, which is really a body of laws that were about the last vestiges of Dillon's rule being moved from and moving into home rule and
yeah.
local decisions to be made and broad general laws and broad structure to be given to local bodies. And then the local bodies, locally elected, could decide how to govern themselves to the power that they have to create new departments, which they absolutely can do. And they can do that. But again, I don't know that they could supervise personnel except personnel directly reporting to the county council, such as a fiscal administrator or staff to support them related to their legislative and their fiscal body function. Now, they could argue that data is so intrinsic to that, maybe that they should have authority over that. I don't think that's a weak argument.
Mm-hmm.
But as to purchasing itself, I think that's an argument that gets more complicated in light of the power to contract being expressly in statute granted to the county commissioners. It's not clear to me, even with that section of the law that's dealing with, abrogating the old Dillon's rule and going to home rule, whether or not that law actually, again, confers authority to take contract authority away or the power to supervise personnel outside of the direct fiscal and legislative functions of the county council. I know that's a mouthful.
Well, Michael, it sounds like it's just going to have to start. Obviously, this ordinance that we mentioned at the outset of the conversation that the county council put out is going to have to be reviewed by the county commissioners, and I'm sure that it's probably not going to be liked, and so it'll probably get turned down. So at least it's going to have to be the start of some kind of discussion between the council and the commissioners to try to work these things out, to be able to balance, as you mentioned, it's check and balances here, try to balance out the power. So there's going to be an awful lot of discussion that's going to have to come before anything might ever get really done, I suppose.
Yes, I do think that there's a great deal of power in having, you know, they used to call it the Big Ten out there, you know, the seven members of the county council and the three members of the county commission. They basically do need a dialogue when it comes to these kinds of things. There's obviously something at work. I know what the papers have reported, but it's legitimate for the county council exercising its inherent powers because it has the power to give a permission to spend. That power is robust, and it's really intrinsically tied to a power of some oversight. And so obviously in exercising oversight, this will definitely get the commissioner's attention.
Yeah.
And it may give them a way to talk about the specifics if they believe that there's been qualitative issues with the way in which purchasing has been conducted or the way in which data processing has been managed. I know that there was some concern, and I think this is legitimate, that there weren't steps taken to prevent the kind of hacks that the county had to pay a good deal of money for, where they were, I think, victims of ransomware.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a risk that all of us experience, by the way.
Yeah.
And we're all at risk for that now in the modern age when we rely on the power of the computer and either wide area networks and the internet to perform work and be more accessible to the people we're serving, our residents or our citizens. At the same time, that means that we're vulnerable then to those kinds of things. So I do think that those are legitimate subjects over which the county council has legitimate as a co-equal branch concern over. Again, I do think that it gets more complicated when it comes to being able to take away supervisory power or the power to contract in an area like purchasing, which is so inherently tied to the power of purchasing,
yeah.
Power of contracting, which is expressly granted the county commission in state law. And I hope they can work it out. If they can't and the county commissioners feel strongly enough, it may well be they either could acquiesce to what's happening by virtue of an override if that's conducted by the county council, or they'll have to have it settled in an actual case before a judge, yeah. I'm afraid.
Well, Michael, we're going to have to leave it at that. There's a lot more to come on this topic, to be sure, and we appreciate you spending time, even with the nerdiness, as you say, giving us this very in-depth explanation as to why the situation has come up and some of the thinking behind it. And it all comes back to home rule, because that's how the reforms were put in place. And
exactly.
Sometimes I suppose this is the unintended action of going to home rule, to be sure, one of the things to talk about. Michael Griffin is, besides being the longtime clerk treasurer in the town of Highland, he's also an adjunct professor at the IU Northwest campus, teaching public budget and finance. And thank you for spending time to talk with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me, Chris. I appreciate it very much.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Porter County Substance Abuse Council is addressing the unintended consequences of substance abuse disorder, and they also are trying to forge some community partnerships to help reduce what are called recidivism rates. That's all, of course, related to drug-related crimes, and there have been some good programs that have been underway in Porter County. Let's find more about them and the rest of the work of the Substance Abuse Council. We have with us on the phone from Porter County, we have Chuck Harris. He's the president of the board of the council, as well as Dawn Pelk. She is the executive director of the Porter County Substance Abuse Council. And Dawn and Chuck, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you.
Well, Dawn, I'll let you speak. Give us an idea of, for folks that are not familiar with the council, what the Porter County Substance Abuse Council is all about.
Well, the Porter County Substance Abuse Council is the hub in the county of Porter. And we address prevention, treatment, and recovery issues with substance use disorder. And we have different programs and strategies throughout the county And so basically we just get people, groups, providers, agencies in the county to get together in order to do some of these activities that need to be done.
When you get the information in that comes in from the agencies, and we're talking not only about nonprofits, governmental agencies, even law enforcement, do you have to sort through it, I guess, first to be able to determine, first off, if it's something that, the council can deal with, or do you have an opportunity just by your general, general action, to be able to take a look at these and try to help the organizations try to resolve this?
Well, we have an epidemiologist on staff that is able to go through all the data that we collect, and we compile the comprehensive community plan, which will let us know what is trending in the community. So we address those points. Right now we have underage drinking, heroin, opioids, and marijuana are our top three priorities. But then if there's something else that we notice within the community that needs attention, we will use our resources to address those problems so we can get a quick turnaround before things get out of hand.
Now, Dawn, I know that you had attended a national criminal conference, a national criminal justice conference last fall. And you came away from that conference with some very interesting information. And how did that in turn help you and your board direct the work that you're doing now?
Well, I was sent to the conference, and it was basically criminology, the causes and consequences and all that, which I don't really have a extensive background in that, so some of it was over my head. But as I was listening to all these presentations, the takeaway that I got that all these people, the speakers on all these panels, were at one time incarcerated, and then they told the story about how they went from incarceration through education, and then they were able to be self-sustaining and increase their quality of life. So it just, that was like my main takeaway. So I had the idea on the way home to talk to Chuck and the board to see if we could work with other community providers to do something about that to reduce the recidivism.
Now, Chuck, if you will, tell us, since you represent the board, being the president of the board and your colleagues on the board, how did you take the information that Dawn had brought back to you and brought to the board? How did you take it, and what did you feel that you could do as a board to be able to bring providers together or set up these partnerships to help deal with the problems?
Right. Well, we appreciate everything that Dawn does for our organization, first of all, because she goes above and beyond for our organization. But when she brought that information back, we do have a coalition that we sit down and we have monthly meetings with them. And when we told them about this idea, just kind of spitballing the idea out there for everybody to hear, everybody realized that the recidivism rates are very high. And to try to break those, the programs that Dawn had heard about seemed like a very viable option. So we approached the coalition about those programs, and just like Porter County always does, is everybody was all on board. They were very eager to get something started, and we had a lot of organizations like the Respite House, Recovery Connection, Ivy Tech, IUN, the Sheriff's Department, Center of Workforce Innovations. It was really amazing how the whole community got together and wanted to all jump on board with this idea. So it was a very collective effort on all those organizations that I just mentioned to you, and a few others as well.
Chuck, if you will, tell us about some of these organizations that are part of the coalition here. For example, like the Recovery Connection, how do they fit into the picture of trying to deal with and make sure that the people who are treated for substance abuse maybe have gone to jail and have served some time, but to try to keep them from going back into jail?
Right. Well, Recovery Connection will try to get people treatment. They also try to help people with different aspects of the recovery process as well. And Recovery Connection was definitely one of those organizations that they were one of the main people at the table trying to get this program started, and they are going to be a very vital part of this process to get people that are seeking help to us, and we can get them into these types of programs.
Now, Dawn, can you tell us a little bit about the work that you're able to do in connection with the leading the board and working with the Recovery Connection?
Well, sure. Recovery Connection has really taken the lead in this project. They're actually known as the hub of Porter County as far as recovery initiatives go. And so their coordinator, Christy Shervinek, she has worked with me as well as the other people on this committee she can provide the space. So if there's anybody out there listening that either knows somebody that needs a GED, formerly known as, it's now called an HSC, a high school equivalency,
mm-hmm.
we're going to, her place is going to be the addendum site, so they will be able to actually take the classes, and then there's support from IUN and Ivy Tech as life coaches are going to be there to help, so nobody gets discouraged. And then when they get to the point where they need to take their test, that site is also a proctor site, an addendum site through Work One. So there is a program like this in the jail, but then also if people are in recovery or anybody that's a Porter County resident that would like to fulfill their goal of getting their diploma, they're able to do so at the Recovery Connection location. And then from there on, we're thinking that we are going to be filtering people to college if that's what they want to do at Ivy Tech, as well as we could provide additional credentialing. There's some apprenticeship opportunities available, and there's credentialing for OSHA 10 to assist with, application and all that to get into an apprenticeship. So there's different opportunities once you get the diploma. And then also at this point, we're working with the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana, like as an incentive, if you are continuing in this program and you're hitting all your benchmarks, as far as getting your credentials, the HSC, then we will provide like a food box scholarship that we're calling it through the food bank. So as you can see, like there's all these different people involved and all these different agencies to try to help someone get the GED, because it's not really as easy as it sounds. There's all these obstacles people have to overcome. So we are here to help.
Now, Chuck, if you'll tell us a little bit more about the Respite House and Mitch Peters, who's the founder of the Recovery Home. How does he fit into all of this and helping deal with the issue of recidivism and trying to keep people who have gone to jail and served time because of drug-related crimes to help keep them out? What is his role in fitting in all this and working with the overall work, I suppose, of the Porter County Substance Abuse Council?
Well, Mitch is a great leader here in our community, and he is one of the people that started Respite House, and he's actually in the process of completing the second Respite House right now here in Porter County.
Mm-hmm.
So he's down on the front lines. He is one of the people that probably works with substance abuse people more than anybody in our community. He is housing people, men that are trying to get help in our community. They try to keep them there at the facility. They go out for work. And one of the problems that people have that have had substance abuse problems is just the education. They don't have the education to get the jobs. And if you don't have that education, people seem to fall back in the same problems that they've had previously. So his main goal is just to help his clients get a little bit of education, And then possibly once they get that HSE, or the formerly known as the GED, once they get that, then possibly move over to like a certification in different professions, and maybe a possible apprenticeship in the building trades to help people. Once they have that security of a job and an income, it helps with other aspects of their lives as well.
Now, Don, if you will, tell us the works that has already been underway, and I'm sure continuing on, inside the Porter County Jail. They've been working very hard to help try to keep the number of people from coming back into the jail because of many drug-related crimes and because of maybe the overall substance abuse disorder that they face.
Right. Well, we have a good relationship, working relationship with the sheriff, Sheriff Reynolds, as well as the chaplain there, Jay Berkey, and they have a chemical dependence and addiction program as well as a therapeutic community, and they also have a space, the God Pod, where they do different things as far as education and things like that. Talking to Jay, he said their program alone with just the chemical dependence and addiction program has reduced recidivism by 45%. So they're doing a great job, and we just wanted to partner with them to, you know, help them once the people, the incarcerated, get out of jail, just, you know what I mean, like a continuum of care. So that way, all of a sudden, they're out of jail, and they don't know where else to go. Then we have them move to Recovery Connection, where there's all kinds of additional programs, like they have the AA programs, NA, Smart Recovery, and all that. So the Porter County Substance Abuse Council just in essence acts as a coordinator. So we coordinate all these different agencies together, and we're just trying to give hope to the community and move everything forward. That's what we're here for.
Now, Chuck and Dawn, can you give us phone numbers or contact numbers where if anybody has concerns in Porter County, they know of family members or others that need help, where can they get it? And if they need to reach you folks at the Substance Abuse Council, how they can do so?
Well, the Porter County Substance Abuse Council's phone number, if you need some kind of a referral, if you have a loved one or know somebody that has substance abuse issues, the number here is 219-462-0946, 462-0946. And then also, if anybody listening has somebody that they know or even themselves that need to complete their GED, their slash HSE, we have openings right now. And the number you can call, that's Christy at Recovery Connection. Her number is 219-510-6319. If you again need the GED, it's 219-510-6319.
Dawn Pelk is Executive Director of the Porter County Substance Abuse Council, and Chuck Harris is the President of the Board of the Substance Abuse Council. And thank you both very much for being with us to talk about the subject, and we're glad to hear some good news and pass along to everybody here on the program today.
Thanks for the opportunity, Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. And that's it for Regionally Speaking today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Be with you tomorrow.